I just got back from India a few days ago, and I'm just going to be traveling in a few days. But yeah, when Rajiv told me we're all getting together this evening, I was really, really enthusiastic to be with everyone. I think Rajiv is saying like you guys are going to get a lot out of this evening, and I think we all do. I get a lot out of it. I think when sincere, serious, spiritual people come together, trying to find the truth, then so many illuminations come, and yeah, it feels like, you know, divinity speaks to us through this searching that we do together. So I'm really enthusiastic for this evening. Questions and answers are amazing because I guess they really get to the heart of what's going on in our minds, our lives. So yeah, please feel free, like whatever you're going through, there's no judgment here. You can just be totally honest, and there may be doubts, there may be inspirations, there may be confusions, and there just may be inquisitiveness about certain things, and we encourage all of you to just, yeah, open-heartedly share that. And yeah, I mean, Rajiv's saying I'm here. I've created a lot of this content. I really feel like I'm, what to say, spiritual plagiarist, you know? I just kind of take things from, all the amazing things I've heard from my teachers and my inspirations, and I just try to share them, hopefully according to what I've experienced in my life. So, I hope it is useful. And yeah, without giving a long introductory speech, I guess we can just shoot in and see what you guys may want to talk about this evening. Just to say, like, there may be philosophical questions, which definitely we can explore. There may be practical questions about how that philosophy applies, what it means in daily life. We can look at that. You may have questions about the Hare Krishna movement, what it all means in the modern day. So we can talk about that. You may have questions about the world we're living in and what the Gita has to say about things you observe day to day around you. We can talk about that. So we can talk about loads and loads of different things. And yeah, just yeah, be as free as you like and open and honest. So yeah, how do we do it, Rajiv? Is everyone just like putting their hands up, unmuting, or do you have a series of questions, or how shall we proceed?
Yeah, so we'll do a mix of both because we've got lots of questions in. So people have sent them in beforehand. So we'll try and get through them. And then whilst the session is going on, if people want to ask a question, then please pose it to myself directly, or questions, as co-host labeled questions, and then they will feed it to me. And then if you're on the call, if you say your name, if you want to ask I might also put you on the spot and ask you to read your own question out if you're comfortable doing that. If not, then I can ask for you. So, okay, let's get underway then. Let's get the session started. So the first question, before we go into the deeper stuff, and I guess this is a sort of a starting point, is obviously you mentioned that you had spiritual plagiarism. You had a connection with the Gita. We heard about how you've taken the Gita and made it accessible to everyone. Where did your journey with the Gita start, and why is it still relevant to you today? Why is it that this knowledge is something you're so inspired to share with everyone, and what inspiration does it give you, day to day as well?
Yeah. Well, my journey began with the Gita at about 15 years old. I grew up in a family in which the Gita was present, but was kind of like an untouched book, a relic on the bookshelf that was part of any good spiritual cultural home, but was never really explored. And when I was 15, I don't know what it was, just there was an inquisitiveness that was growing within me to find out about life. I guess I grew up in a family where it was a really nice upbringing. I had everything I needed. But still, naturally, questions come to your mind. And so I started reading when I was 16. I guess I started discussing, coming to the temple and asking questions. And I think that's really when my spiritual journey took another, went to another level. As I tell you my journey in spiritual life, I think there's something generally you can learn from that. I think the first stage of spiritual life is just exploring knowledge yourself. That's like the first major landmark. I think another major landmark is coming in contact with spiritual people and having really significant spiritual conversations, which for me happened at about 16. And then I think at 18, I went to university, and that's where I got actively involved in practicing and also serving and trying to give something back, share spirituality with others, whatever I had learned. And I think that's probably like the third level of seriousness. And then when I graduated, then I decided to go to India. And I think that's probably, like another level of spiritual progression when you really decide to sacrifice something and really invest something of your life into understanding this in a deeper way. So, when I was 21, I went to India and traveled around, became a monk. The rest is history, as they say. So, it grew from inquisitiveness, my journey with the Gita, and it's continued over the past 30 years because of the amazing wisdom that the Gita just has, you know. It's like one of my favorite things to do is just hang out in Waterstones and just see what kind of books are coming out and see what people are writing about. And I love to try and keep my fingers on the pulse. And I just find like whenever I read stuff in Waterstones, like there's also this website on the internet, it's called like 5 Minute Book or something, where you can like figure out what every book says in like 5 minutes. So then I just read all these things and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. But this is already there in the Gita. They say like, if you want to find a new idea, go to an old book. And it's like every time I read stuff, I'm like, wow, this is already in the Bhagavad Gita. People are just making it more accessible, but it's already there in the Gita. And so it never fails to fascinate me how the knowledge of the Gita is being reproduced in the world every single day in a different way, in different language, with different techniques. But the seeds of those thoughts are there. And it just reaffirms my faith that the Bhagavad Gita has everything that we need to answer all of our questions, to become the best versions of ourselves. And therefore, I continue to study it. Nearly 30 years later, and it's just an inspiration. Like we're with Rajiv now, we're putting together a whole bunch of new material for Think Gita, and it's so inspiring. Because, you know, in the coming months, we're going to be talking about the Gita and leadership. We're going to talk about the Gita and resilience. We're going to talk about the Gita and purpose, Gita and relationships, Gita and love. And as we research these topics, it's just blowing our minds because we're like, wow, the Gita is probably the most versatile literature in the world, which can answer practically anything. So it's just an amazing journey. So yeah, the Bhagavad Gita is like a zip file, and if you got the right program, you can unzip so much from it. So yeah, some thoughts.
Wow, amazing! Thank you so much, and that's such a inspiring answer. How you've connected so well with the Gita and inspiring us. So yeah, I'll pick up on a point that you said. So you said there's going to be different courses on Gita and relationships, Gita and resilience, and these things. So maybe let's start with Gita and resilience or Gita and difficulties? Because I've grouped the questions in this format. Okay, so we'll go for difficulty because we're all facing difficulties in some way or another. So our first question is from Karuna, and she's asked, when dealing with something difficult, how do you have faith in things that, how do you have faith that things will turn out okay? And do you have any tips to get rid of past bad karma?
So in difficult situations, how do you have faith that things are going to be okay? And then we'll take the karma thing later on. Well, the first thing that the Bhagavad Gita teaches us is not to have unrealistic expectations. So here's how the Bhagavad Gita tells you to approach difficulty. Number one, this is the mantra you need to embed in your mind. Number one, adjust your expectation. Number two, accept your situation. Number three, aspire for connection. That's basically the approach to difficulties. The first thing the Gita teaches you is adjust your expectation, that the world is meant to be uncomfortable. The world is meant to be full of challenges, obstacles, issues, problems. The world is meant to be filled with uncertainty, because the world is designed in that way for us to actually awaken a deeper consciousness, for us to kind of to jolt ourselves out of an illusion, to help us search for some deeper sense of peace, to find a more profound type of happiness. So the first thing the Gita teaches us is that the world is designed to be uncomfortable. And so don't be surprised. Don't be surprised when challenges come, when obstacles come. It's part of the design. But then the Gita goes on to teach us, number two, accept your situation, that in that discomfort, in those difficulties, there's something that amazing that we can learn. There's something amazing that we can grow from. There's something extraordinary that we can discover. But that can only happen if you learn to accept your situation. Oftentimes what we're doing is we're fighting, we're frustrated, we're kind of hoping that things will change. We kind of look up at God and say, God, change my situation. And God is looking down at us saying, but I sent that situation, so you change yourself. In other words, to accept your situation, to really embrace it and say, I'm meant to be here. It's struggle, it's difficult, but I'm meant to be here. Why am I meant to be here? What am I meant to learn? And so the Gita teaches you to don't try and leave situations, but try and learn from situations. We'll often find that the same thing keeps happening to us like a deja vu, like a groundhog day. And the reason is because we're not learning from situations. So the same situation comes back to teach us again. So accept your situation. And then the third thing is aspire for connection. That the discomfort of this world helps us to realize that we're made for another world. C.S. Lewis said, if I find within myself a desire which no experience of this world can fulfill, I must conclude I was made for another world. And so all of this is meant to help us become inspired, enthused, become serious about connecting to another reality, a spiritual reality, connecting to a sacred space beyond the chaos of this world. And when we make that connection, then everything becomes perfect. So how do we know everything's going to be perfect in life, how it's all going to work out? Well, the Gita says the first thing is adjust your expectation. Second thing is accept your situation. And the third thing is aspire for connection. And once you go on that trajectory, they say peace is not the absence of anxiety. Peace is the presence of God in every single situation. So we somehow have this notion that peace or everything turning around or turning out okay, is that all my problems disappear. But real peace, real everything turning out okay, is just to have the presence of God, divinity, spirituality in every situation. And then automatically you'll find a stability, a steadiness, a serenity of consciousness. So, I hope that helps a little bit. And any tips to get rid of your karma? Just learn. Why does karma come to you? It's a lesson. Karma is nature's way of teaching us something about life. And you know what? If you learn the lesson, then that karma doesn't have to come back to you again. But while we don't learn the lesson, then we accrue more and more karma, because it's the universe, it's the world, it's God shouting out to us to learn something. So we have to learn from all the reactions, the emotions, experiences, events of life. And when we do that, then the karma disappears because you've learned the lesson. And then you may say, well, how am I supposed to learn the lesson from whatever karma I'm going through? That's why you have spiritual books. That's why you have spiritual people. That's why you have spiritual prayer, because these things help you to decode your karma. So how do you get rid of your karma? Just learn the lesson. And then the karma has no more function. Is that okay? I don't know if Karuna's on the call, if she wants to kind of follow that up or ask something more on that. Okay, Karuna, thank you. Thank you for your question. That was a beautiful question. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Karuna. So following on from that, so you mentioned about ways that we can elevate our anxiety and, practical ways we can overcome that. Well, another question that we had from someone anonymously was, they feel that they have it's in their personality trait to be anxious by nature. You know, they get worked up very easily. So they've asked specifically, how do they change this personality trait? Because, you've said practical ways, but what if it's like inbuilt almost?
Yes, it's such a great question. Well, the Gita opens by saying we have three aspects to our identity. We have a gross physical body. We have a subtle mind and intelligence. And beyond that, we're the soul. So when you say, I am an anxious person, or I am a greedy person, it's not really you. It's just the temporary conditioning of the mind you have. Like if you have a light bulb and you have a blue shade on it, it comes out as blue light. But it's not really blue light. It's just light, and it's coming out as blue because you put a blue shade over it. So the original pure consciousness of the soul then exhibits itself with certain personality traits according to the shade of the mind. And therefore, one of the most amazing things about the Gita is it tells you how to remold your mind. You're not an anxious person. You're a pure soul who has a mind which is conditioned to worry. And the great news is that you can remold your mind. But it takes time. Just like if you go into the internet and you browse the internet with a browser, so you have Mozilla or you have Chrome or Edge or whatever you're using. Now, every browser has a history. Every browser has a homepage. Every browser has its favorites. Every browser has like its autocomplete, so that when you say www.a, a whole bunch of options come up. So think of your mind like an internet browser. Your mind has a history. Your mind has a certain default homepage that it keeps going back to. Your mind has a certain favorites that it gravitates towards. Your mind has an autocomplete, so that when you see something, it automatically brings about certain impressions that you naturally cling on to. But just as you can reconfigure a browser, isn't it? You can change the history. You can delete the favorites. You can readjust the homepage. You can, wipe out the cookies. You can install different plugins. So you can optimize your browser. So in the same way, you can optimize your mind. And therefore, you're not an anxious person. You're a pure soul who has a mind which is conditioned to worry. And that can change. And so what's that process to remold the mind? Arjun was told by Krishna that he has to learn to control his mind. And Arjun was like, that's impossible. To control the mind, I don't think I can change. It's one of the biggest things in the world. People say, like, I can't change. I am who I am. And that's basically what Arjun was saying. But Krishna, in a beautiful verse in the Gita, he says, Ashamshayam mahabaho manodur nigraham chalam abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagyena chagriyate. Krishna says, it's undoubtedly difficult to control or change one's mental disposition, but it's possible through spiritual practice and through spiritual detachment. And it's a great art. And maybe on another occasion, we can go into more detail. But just in reply to the question, you can change. Having the faith that you can change is one of the most important ingredients for spiritual success. You know, most people in this world have given in to the fact that, or a seeming fact that they are who they are, that they can't change. And therefore, they've completely disempowered themselves. So the greatest project is the project on yourself. And that project is so exciting because you can actually change. For me, the most inspiring thing about Krishna consciousness is to see transformation. I see transformation in myself. I see transformation in other people. And for me, that means Krishna consciousness is not a religion. It's a science. It works. And so just do it. Just try it and see how things change.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much. And
My answers now are a little bit long-winded. I'll try and just because I'm on a train of thought, and then you know what it's like. You know, you get excited, and then you just like, you know.
They're great because they're answering a lot of the questions that we've already got. So it's like, I'm just like ticking off, okay, you've answered this. So,
sure.
Okay, so we'll bring it on to the mind then, because you mentioned how the mind is like a browser. It has different things, different tabs. And like you said, it's a science, and we just have to try and sort of apply and see that transformation. And I guess the transformation starts with the mind. Now, one of the questions we had, and this is probably one of the hardest things to control with the mind, is anger. So one of the questions we had, when it is hard to control anger, and sometimes this person feels they just lose it, and then they, after a while, they make amends. But how do you control it in the first place? Now, I guess I'll put these two questions for you to you. One is, how do you control anger? The second is around ego. So how do you manage the ego? Because the ego is kind of, we hear that, you know, the ego is kind of propping itself up and taking over a lot of the time. So how do you manage these two things specifically?
Anger and ego. Yeah. Okay, well, let me share with you what Krishna says about anger. This is the science of how anger comes about. Dhyayato vishayan pumsha sangaste supajayate sangat sanjayate kama kama krodho vijayate. So this is it. This is how anger comes about. Krishna says, dhyayato, dhyan, like you have Zen Buddhism. Zen, the word Zen comes from dhyan, which means meditation. So Krishna says, the first step towards anger is that you're constantly meditating on something. Sangha. The second step is because you constantly meditate on something, you become attached to it. When you become attached to something, karma, you lust after it, you really want it. And from karma comes krodha, which means anger. Okay? So you see, this is basically the progression of how anger comes about. First, you constantly meditate on something. Then that constant meditation leads to an attachment. The attachment then leads to a strong desire to have something or experience something in a certain way. And then it leads to anger, because invariably it doesn't work out, or you get it and it doesn't feel like what you expected it to feel like. So the root cause of anger is that we have attachment. We have attachment to have something, to be perceived in a certain way, to control a certain situation. And because we're attached to something, when it doesn't work out how we want it to work out, then we become angry. So you see, attachment is the precursor to anger. Now, what people therefore try and do in the world is they try to control the outer world so that everything works according to my attachment, and then I won't be angry. But that's the wrong way of going about it. Instead, what you do is you work on the inner world and you change your attachment to detachment. And when you have detachment, no matter how it works out in the material world, you'll never be angry, because you can't be angry if you don't have attachment. So the problem in the world today is that we're too much attached to the world functioning in a certain way, to people being in a certain way. And because we attach to that, it brings about anger. So therefore, the root cause to solving problems of anger is to learn a detachment. Now you may say, like, how can you be detached from the world? How can you be detached, you know, from... the way you become detached is when you realize that you don't need to control the outer world. You don't need to control the outer world. You don't need to control other people. You don't need the fortunes of life to go in a certain direction to be happy. You don't really need anything outside of you to be in any particular way, to find the truest contentment of the heart. You don't need to control the outer world. You just need to become fully at peace with the inner world. And then you just become detached, because you realize, I'm not dependent on any of these things. But when you have attachment, you go with the notion that I'm dependent on so many things. And then that invariably leads to anger. So anger is rooted in that attachment. And then Krishna goes on to say, what happens when you have anger? Krodhat bhavati sammoha, sammoha smriti vibhrama, smriti bhramsad buddhi naso buddhi nasat pranashyati. So the initial progression, you got it, right? We meditate on something, then it brings attachment. When we have attachment, then we have lust. And when we have lust, it brings about anger. So that's how you get to anger. And now Krishna tells you what happens when you become angry. So Krishna says, when you're angry, the next thing that happens, sammoha, you become bewildered. You can't think straight. Prodat bhavati sammoha, sammoha smriti vibhrama. Then you forget. You forget what's the most progressive way of living? You lose your intelligence. Your intelligence becomes covered. And then Krishna says, pranashyati, then your life is headed in a very negative direction. Therefore, they realized that the most successful people in the world were not just the people who had the highest IQ. They used to think it was all about IQ. Later on, they realized, what's the point of having such high IQ if you don't have EQ, if you don't have emotional quotient, if you don't know how to control your own anger? Because if you can't control your anger, all your intelligence gets covered anyway. And then later on, they realized it's not even about IQ and EQ. You need SQ, spiritual quotient. You need purpose. You need identity. You need meaning. You need a sense of direction. You need a why. Without spirituality, you have no strong why. So IQ, EQ, SQ. Yeah, that's the ingredients to a happy life. So anyway, I kind of went around, but yeah, that's basically where anger comes from. You can say attachment.
Thank you so much, and I hope that
It's quite a philosophical answer, what I've given you there. That's like literally what Krishna says. But if you go home and deeply think about that, think about anything you've become angry about. Like, I'm angry because my partner cheated on me, for example. Like, just sit down and think about that for some time, and you'll be able to see this live. It works. This is wisdom that breathes. You're my point.
Great. Thank you so much. I hope that answered the question around anger for a lot of people. Like, this is not planned, but we've kind of nicely gone on to the next topic. I guess there's two leads of this topic we can go into. One is purpose, because you talked about the why. Like, why do you have, if you have the why, then it's, then you can move in that direction where you can control your anger and you have that SQ, spiritual quotient. So I guess let's dive deep into a little bit about purpose. So I guess I'll ask two questions that have come in based around that. So firstly, the first question is, how important is it to have the why? So how important is it to have purpose in life? How do we find it? And how do we know when we've got it? And I guess following on from that, which is, how do you become the best version of yourself?
Wow, beautiful question. Okay, let's go bit by bit. Is it important to know your purpose? In one word, yes. One of my mentors used to say, the best alarm clock in the world is purpose. When your eyes open in the morning, if you have purpose, you'll jump out of bed. I mean, it's a good measure. If you're kind of struggling to get out of bed in the morning, it probably means you haven't found your purpose. Of course, there are times when you're tired and you have jet lag and you just need to just sleep, you know. But overall, if we're not inspired about life, it means we don't have a why. We don't have a purpose. So yeah, we need purpose. We need a meaning. We need a bright future that we're looking forward to. We need to work towards something. Life is creative. Life means creation. We've got to make a creative offering in this world. And all of that is driven by purpose, to know like what offering, what creative thing I'm meant to do while I'm here. So purpose is super important. It's the best alarm clock in the world. How do you find your purpose? For most people, their purpose doesn't just appear to them like overnight. Purpose generally is unraveled over time. The first thing you have to do is attempt different things. Just try. Don't be scared. Don't just stay stuck in what you've always been doing. They say the most dangerous phrase in the English language is, we've always done it this way. So don't be afraid to just try new things, to try a different way of approaching life. Attempt. Second thing is analyze. Look at your personality. Do personality tests. Find out more about who you are, what makes you tick. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What deep fears do you have within you? What inspirations do you have? Get to know yourself better. Most people don't actually know themselves that well, although they're like, I've known myself my whole life. But maybe don't actually know yourself. So analyze your personality. You can do like all these personality tests and things. They're useful. And then the third thing is ask. Have people around you who can give you feedback, who can tell you like, you're really good at this, or you should really try and do that. Sometimes we just need someone to inject a little bit of faith in us. They say one of the biggest gifts you can have in your life is a person who has more faith in you than you have in yourself. So ask people. So you want to find your purpose, attempt different things, analyze your personality, and ask people who know you. And it will come. And then the third thing I would say is, you know, for most people, they may know their purpose. But sometimes even harder than finding your purpose is having the bravery to live your purpose. Do you know in life there's a tension between comfort and aspiration? There's a tension between security and dreams. There's a tension between the comfort zone and the creative zone. And most people tend to just stay for comfort, for security, for safety, for the path of least resistance. Most people, even when they know their purpose, they don't have the bravery. They don't have the courage. They don't have the confidence to follow their purpose. Therefore, it's not just about knowing your purpose. It's about having that drive to live your purpose. And that's also a big thing. So, anyway. So these are some things on purpose.
Thank you.
And just to say, like, purpose, how does the Bhagavad Gita begin? The very first word of the Bhagavad Gita, Dharma Kshetre Kuru Kshetre Samaveta Yuyotsava Mamaka Pandavascheva Kimakurvata Sanjaya. This is the first verse of the Gita, but the very first word of the very first verse of the Gita is Dharma. And Dharma means purpose. So the whole thrust of the Bhagavad Gita is to help you find purpose. You're on mute, Raji.
And so finding purpose, is that the way to become the best version of yourself, or is there more to it than finding your purpose? Because if you found your purpose, does that mean you're the best version of yourself, or does it mean you have other things you have to concentrate on?
Once you know your purpose, then you have to work on yourself to be able to fulfill that purpose. It's not like now I know my purpose, I'm automatically the best version of myself. Like, say, for example, at one point I knew, I discovered that my purpose was to, for example, to maybe teach, to share knowledge, to live a certain lifestyle and do that as an offering to the world. The other thing just on my mind, I would say purpose is useless unless you use it in service of others. Purpose is never selfish, right? Dharma means a contribution you're meant to make to the world, right? So it's not like, my purpose is just to do this. Like, my purpose is to have like two cars, two houses, two phones, too much, you know, like that kind of selfish mentality is not purpose. Your purpose is something that you're meant to do, which makes the world a better place, which makes other people happy. So purpose is always for service. Yeah. So at one point I realized what my purpose was. And then that was so good for me because it meant I needed to then become the best version of myself so I could actually fulfill that purpose. So then I began working on myself, my personality, my mindset, my skills, so that I could actually then make that contribution to the world. So yeah, once you know what your purpose is, you then begin working on yourself in order to become the best instrument in order to fulfill that purpose. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Does that make sense to everyone? Maybe you can put yes in the chat if it makes sense. To me, it does, but it'd be nice to hear from everyone as well. One interesting thing you mentioned was let other people have more faith in you than in yourself. Like, so you mentioned that more people have faith in you than in yourself when you were describing about finding purpose. Now, we can maybe relate to that in a sense, or maybe I can imagine that in a sense, and that this is a question that's also come in, is when we're growing up, we often see parents having faith in their children, but that faith actually becomes expectation to be a certain way, expectation to fulfill a certain purpose, etc. So how do you deal with expectations from others, I guess others including parents?
See, expectations are a necessary part of life. It's good that people have expectations in us, because expectations can inspire us, expectations can help us rise beyond what we think we can do. Expectations can inspire us, but expectations can also become like a burden. Expectations can also become like something which feel very heavy and difficult to fulfill. What's really important is whose expectations we accept. Because if you accept everyone's expectations, it's going to be overwhelming. If you accept nobody's expectations, you may just end up being very mediocre in your life. So the real question is not whether we should accept expectations or not. We have to. But who do we accept the expectations of with greater seriousness? So this is what I would say to you. If there are people in your life who know you, who love you, and who have the spiritual acumen to really help you, their expectations count for more. Right? So 100 people may have expectations of you. But amongst those 100 people, there will be one person maybe who's like, I know you, Rajiv. And you know what, Rajiv? I love you. Your best interests are what I have in my heart. And you know what, Rajiv? I have some spiritual awareness that helps me to know what will be best for you. Now, if I have all of those three qualities, then you'll look at me and you'll say, you know what? Your expectations count for more. But oftentimes what we do is we accept the expectations of people who don't know us, people who don't love us, and people who don't necessarily have the spiritual maturity to be able to help us. And those kind of expectations are not helpful. We honor people, we respect people, but we don't take everyone's expectations on an equal level. take the expectations of those who know you, who love you, and who can actually help you, take their expectations more seriously, and their expectations will help you to grow to unimaginable heights. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Your expectations count for me for sure. So I hope that wasn't just an example. I hope you actually meant that. okay, thank you.
Well, I can say I love you, Rajiv.
Oh, I love you too much. Okay, so okay, we've kind of got into a little bit about purpose. Rome has asked, I guess maybe you kind of answer this, but can expectations take you away from your own dharma?
Not if they're expectations from someone who knows you, loves you, and has the spiritual insight to be able to help you. Rather, they'll be the conduit of helping you find your purpose. Yeah. But if you accept the expectations of people who don't have those qualities, it will take you away from your purpose. Like, everyone has an opinion about what you should be doing. Yeah? It's like everyone has an opinion. So, like, you have to accept the opinions of selected people. That doesn't mean it's like you disrespect everyone else, but you can't also take everyone on the same level of seriousness.
Thank you. So, okay, so I think we've covered purpose nicely, and I think there was another question from Komal, which I think you've covered in a sense about most people, they don't do jobs they love, but how do you explain that? So I think we kind of covered that in one sense.
We work for money. We work for pleasing others. We work for social acceptance. We work for having a position in the world. All of these things just give you temporary gratification. They don't give you fulfillment of the heart. We have to work for something we really believe in. Now, the reality of life is that you need to earn a living. The reality of life is that you need to pay bills. And the reality of life is that you can't always do what you love for a living. But what I would say is work towards that. You know, work, it doesn't happen overnight. But don't be satisfied with mediocrity. If what you're doing right now, your career, is not what you love, it's not the contribution you want to make to the world, but it gives you money, then gradually start thinking about how you can adjust your life into a way of working that is more in line with your dharma. One of our friends, he was a lawyer and he was earning so much money and he was like, this is not my contribution to the world, but I'm getting paid well. So what he did is, instead of doing 5 days as a week as a lawyer, he continued on and did 4 days. And he said, for one day, I'm going to be a coach. That way, I still got 4 days of income coming in, but I can begin exploring what I really love. And in that one day, he started doing so well that he reduced his 3 days as a reduced to 3 days as a lawyer and started doing coaching for 2 days. And today, he's not a lawyer anymore. He's a coach. He's doing what he loves, and the amazing thing is that he earns more than what he was earning as a lawyer, and he's contributing to people's lives. So you can't turn the ship around in one fell sweep, you know. It takes time, but work towards that. Make your daydream your day job. That should be like the North Star, a guiding mantra. And you may say, that's utopian, that's unrealistic, that's not how the real world works. Well, that's up to you. Then I don't want to be part of the real world. Like, life is short, you know. Your job is like so many hours. They did it. You can look on the internet. It's called 80,000 hours. I think there's a website. It's called 80,000 hours. And 80,000 hours is basically what you'll spend in your life working. That's how much time you'll spend. And we can't just be doing it for money. It's just, that would be such a waste. Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. Make your daydream your day job. I've written that down. Okay, so you said, okay, most of our day is made up of our job. So then another question has come in around, okay, so day to day, what would you say? And this person's asked for five things, but it, obviously it doesn't have to be five things. Day to day, what, in your opinion, what key principles from the Gita, which we can implement in our daily lives today?
Who was that question from?
Let me just find it. Okay. I just put it on the chat.
Upesh.
Upesh? Okay, wonderful. It's such a nice question. So what five things does the Gita teach us that we can use to implement in life? There could be many answers to that question, but what I would refer you to is chapters number 14 and 17 of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna talks about the three modes of nature. Because the reason Krishna analyzes the three modes of nature is to help us understand the best type of lifestyle to create in our life. Our lifestyle can be in ignorance. Our lifestyle can be in passion. Our lifestyle can be in goodness. To the extent that you develop lifestyle, character, habits, ways of functioning, which are in the mode of goodness, then you will maximize your achievement in this world. You will maximize your health on a physical and mental levels. You will maximize the beauty of your character. You will maximize your relationships. Basically, you will maximize your happiness. So, what are the best habits and what are Krishna's practical tips for living in this world? All you have to do is deeply understand the three modes of nature. You have to deeply understand what does the mode of goodness or sattva, what does that look like? And then what you can do is in your life, you can learn to drive your car in the mode of goodness. You can learn to parent your children in the mode of goodness. You can learn to eat your lunch in the mode of goodness. You can learn to do your studies at university in the mode of goodness. You can learn to be a corporate leader in the mode of goodness. That's possible, actually. It's not an oxymoron to be a corporate leader and be in the mode of goodness. You can do it. The Dharma of capitalism. But basically, Krishna talks about the mode of goodness. So like, we got to deeply, you know, 100 verses of the 700 verses in the Gita are all about the three modes of nature. And it's like, if you understand the mode of goodness deeply, you can apply it practically to anything. And then you just develop habits, which are just like the most powerful habits in the world. And then you can just deeply achieve what you're meant to achieve in life. Yeah. I hope that I gave a general answer, but I think that may be more help you more. Yeah. We're going to do a Think Gita course on it, right? Gita and lifestyle, or Gita and goodness. Gita and goodness, yeah. That would be a good course.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I think we've nicely covered the purpose, and I think there's more questions around this, but we'll move on to the next topic, which is I think a lot of people that are in this chat might connect with is Gita and relationships. So one question we had, which is kind of a more of a specific question, but I'll just answer it because it might apply and we might get a lot from it. There's two questions actually, and they're both kind of linked, so I'll ask both of them. What guidance does a Gita offer when it comes to making a decision whether or not to give somebody a second chance, as in a romantic partner, when your previous experience has been that this person is not emotionally mature or consistent, choosing to escape rather than face reality and wasn't accountable for their actions, and they have now realized their errors and asked for a second chance? I'll just stop there, actually. That's quite a heavy, loaded question.
Ask the guy in Saffron about romantic relationships. I'm like way out of my depth here, but let me give you some general principles. Let's start at the highest level and then come down to the world we're living in. Krishna says on the highest level, we're all spiritual beings. We're all meant to be in the spiritual world. The spiritual world is the real land of love. That's where you can fully fulfill the heart's desire for deep intimacy and love. But somehow or other, we're here in this world and we're searching for love. Essentially, we're searching for love in the wrong place. We're looking for the right thing, but we're looking in the wrong place. Therefore, so much of this world is about frustrated love, isn't it? You know, all the songs. Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, and the very next day, you threw it away, and all this kind of stuff, you know? So much of life is frustrated love, because we're looking for love, right thing, the wrong place. And therefore, one of the reasons that we're having problem in relationships is because we have unrealistic expectations. For a relationship to really work, it can never just be between two people. There must always be a third factor in there, the spiritual factor, the divine factor, the Krishna factor. Then relationships work. But if it's just two people trying to love each other without any spiritual dimension, it will lead to exploitation. It will lead to a sense of selfishness. It will lead to frustration. It will lead to letdown. So now, coming to your question, if someone has let us down, should we give them a second chance? Relationships are only progressive when those relationships are helping you grow towards finding real love on the deepest level, on the spiritual level. All of you now are on the spiritual journey. And therefore, anyone you try to share your heart with in love has to also really be on that spiritual journey. They may be at a different point. They may be on their own, you know, trajectory, but they should be on that journey. And then a relationship has scope to work if both of you come together to really try to help each other to reach your spiritual goal. In other words, relationships of love are two people coming together to help each other to reach the real goal. It's not just about them and those two and what they can give to each other, but it's what they can contribute to each other so that both of them can reach their spiritual aspirations of divine love. So therefore, when you're making a decision about whether to continue a relationship or discontinue a relationship, when you're trying to figure out, is there something of value in here or is it just toxic? You have to deeply question, are we really able to serve each other to become, to really become the best versions of our spiritual selves to reach that spiritual goal? Are we helping each other or are we hindering each other? Are we supporting each other or are we stifling each other? And then sometimes you have to make the hard decision and you have to walk away and you have to let go and you have to say, this person has to go on their own journey and I have to go on my own journey. And it's tough, but, it may save you a lot of heartache in the future. So I don't come to you today as a relationship expert. For that, you can read like, you know, Jay Shetty's Laws of Relationships or something like that. that may give you much more specific information. I'm telling you on a very high level, of the expectations and the general parameters that we should set when we're having relationships. I hope that helps something. We could go deeper.
So you mentioned about relationships. One of the words I picked up was having deep relationships. We strive for deep relationships. And you said ultimately we want to have a deep relationship with the Supreme. But how do we have, not just with a romantic partner, but with others, how do we develop deep relationships, meaningful relationships?
The depth of a relationship is proportionate to the level of commitment, sacrifice, selflessness, and service in that relationship. Srila Prabhupada, he said that the love between a mother and a child is the purest type of love in the material world. And why did he say that? Because the commitment of the mother, the sacrifice of the mother, the selflessness of the mother, the service mood of the mother towards the child is practically unparalleled in this world. And so whether you're husband and wife, or whether you're parent and child, or whether you're friends coming together, relationships work when you're serving each other. You're helping each other so that those people can fulfill their dreams. And in that selflessness, love comes about. So it's not about, relationships are not like what we can get from the relationship. It's about what we can contribute in service. It's actually a very simple point. I'm not saying something which is groundbreaking, which you haven't heard before, but in every relationship you have to ask, like in Gita 3, here we go, the advert is coming now, but we create this book Gita 3. You can download it from the internet for free, but what we did is we created a table and then we said, like, your spouse, your parents, your children, your colleagues, and then we had two columns and we said, what can you do now? Name one thing you can do in each relationship that will make you less selfish and more selfless. So try it. Create a table. Spouse, parents, devotee friends, all the different relationships you have on one side. And then on the top, have like less selfish and have more selfless. And in every box, you have to write one thing that can help you to be less selfish in that relationship and more selfless in that relationship. And then once you've done the box, you have to actually do it, right? Do it for a week, do it for a month, and see how your relationships begin to transform. That's how you have deep relationships.
Thank you. If anything is resonating with you, please write on the chat. We want to also hear from other people. And so please comment on the chat what's resonating with you, if the question resonated with you, etc. Okay, I'm going to definitely try that exercise, how to have a deeper relationship. But let's say we have a deep relationship, we spend time, we invest and develop in that deep relationship, but then we lose that person, because that's the inevitability of life. We lose them, like they pass away. So the next question is around death. So how do you deal with the loss of a loved one, and how do you find motivation to live after the loss of a loved one?
The first thing is, when someone leaves the world, there is a natural grief. It's not like when you become a spiritual person, you don't grieve anymore. Arjun heard the whole Bhagavad Gita, and then 10 days into the war, his own son, Abhimanyu, died. And when he went to the spot in the battlefield where his son had died, he cried. He shed tears. He was grieving. And he'd be like, but he heard the whole Bhagavad Gita. Why is he in grief? Krishna says, the wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead. But Krishna let him grieve. That's natural. How can you not? You would have to be a very stone-hearted person to not feel anything when someone leaves this world. There's a natural connection there. So I think the first thing is, we don't need to become uncomfortable if we feel a sense of grief when someone leaves the world. It's very natural. It's symptomatic of someone who has a soft heart. You can't have a spiritual heart and not have a soft heart. Soft-heartedness means emotion, and emotion is spirituality. But there's a difference between material emotion and spiritual emotion. So Arjun was grieving for his son, but then in the very next moment, after going through that grief, what did he do? He picked up his bow and he continued fighting. And that's the difference between material emotion and spiritual emotion. When you're materially grieving, then it impedes you from being progressive in your life. It blocks you from moving forward. It causes stagnation. It causes depression. But spiritual emotion, spiritual grief, is accompanied by action. It's accompanied by a sense of ongoing purpose. It's accompanied by a sense of, I remain connected with this person on a deeper level through doing these activities and living in this way. And in that way, spiritual emotion is very, very progressive. So the way I'm answering that question is to say, number one, when someone leaves the world, there's natural grief and emotion. However, there's a difference between material emotion and spiritual emotion. Because material emotion is going to ground you. Material emotion is going to cause you to get stuck in a rut. Whereas spiritual emotion is going to empower you and give you a sense of ongoing purpose. And we stay connected. We stay connected with all souls, even when they've passed away from this world. And the way we stay connected with them is by service, by following their legacy, by living in such a way that that person will continue to be benefited, by living in such a way that that person will be happy and proud. And in this way, we stay connected in relationships. And some thoughts there.
Thank you. Very nice answer, and quite a deep thing. I propose we have maybe 2-3 more questions. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think for me it's okay, but I think maybe 2-3 is good because we're going into the later hours.
Okay. So our last two, I guess these are in the technical category, or and then I'll save one question for the end, which I think is a nice question. So one from Suki, and she's asked, what is Vedanta, and how do we relate it to me and in the world as a discipline, and what comes first, Brahman or Vedanta?
Okay, Brahman or Vedanta? Okay. So first thing is Vedanta. Veda means knowledge and anta means the end. So Vedanta is literally the essence of all Vedic knowledge or the end of Vedic knowledge. So Vedanta is a philosophy. Sometimes we use the word Vedanta as like just philosophy. The Vedanta is also a specific book. There's a book called the Vedanta Sutra, which is a summary of all the Vedic teachings. And so that Vedanta basically contains the, you can say, the keys to life, the universe, and everything. So Vedanta is the books which summarize the perennial philosophy of the Vedas. And that Vedanta talks about Brahman. And Brahman means the supreme, who is in the form of an all-pervading spirit. But Vedanta also talks about Paramatma, the divine who then also manifests within the heart of every living being. And that Vedanta ultimately talks about Bhagavan, the supreme person who we can have a loving relationship with. And so Vedanta, what's the relationship between Vedanta and Brahman? Vedanta is knowledge which teaches you about Brahman, but which then goes on to teach you that Brahman and Paramatma are ultimately emanating from Bhagavan, the supreme divinity, the personality of Godhead, whom each one of us can have a relationship with. And that Vedanta is summarized within the Bhagavad Gita. So the Vedanta is quite complex. The Vedanta is quite terse. Is very difficult to decipher the conclusions because it's very, very philosophical. But the Bhagavad Gita, in a very easy way, unravels the mysteries of Vedanta. And in that way, the Bhagavad Gita is considered to be like the essence of Vedanta.
Thank you.
I hope that helps. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I got another question from Kavita. What is Jivan Mukta?
Oh, that's a nice question. Yeah. Mukta means liberated, and Jivan means while living. So Jivan Mukta means one who's liberated even while they're living. We sometimes have this notion that, oh my God, I'm in the run of the mill of life and I got all these struggles and it's so difficult. And one day I'll just get mukti and I'll just leave this world and I'll just go somewhere else and then I'll be liberated from it all. You know, they say in spirituality, you don't get much pay. You don't get a salary, but the retirement plan is out of this world. So this is what people's notion of mukti is, you know, that it's like I leave the world and then I'm released from the body. I'm released from all these relationships. But what the philosophy of the Gita says is you can be a jivan mukta. You can be living here. You can be functioning in your career, in your family. You can be 100% a part of this society. And at the same time, be completely liberated. In other words, you can be here, but not really here. You can be here, but unaffected by the material influence. You can be here, but living in a sacred space. You can be here, but because you're so content with the inner world, you just rest there. Like a lotus in the middle of the river where not one drop of water sticks, but it just slides off. That's a Jivan Mukta. And Krishna says, when you develop spiritual consciousness, you're almost like you're here, but you're not here. You're like, you're not really part of the world anymore. You're kind of like, yeah. Just living in a different space of consciousness. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you. Okay, so we've got So many questions, nice questions have come in now. I've saved one for the end. What should we go to the last question, or do you have?
Yeah, sure, as you like.
You have a 4 a.m. start tomorrow, so okay, I'll ask the last question then. And this has come from Christy from Middlesbrough, who I bumped into in London. This is a nice question about prayer. So last week we looked at chapters 10 and 11. We looked at Krishna dwelling in our hearts. God resides within us. And her question is, prayer, how can we connect more with God? How do you speak to God? She feels she chats with God as a person, as a friend. It feels right somehow, rather than in the scripture. But there are times when it doesn't flow. So any advice or experience? And maybe you can comment on that, Christy, if I've explained that correctly, your question.
Perfect. That's such a beautiful question. Thank you, Kirsty. Is it Kirsty? Is that the word? Yeah, it's Kirsty. Thank you so much. Such a beautiful question and such a reflective question to end on. Like, how do we pray? How do we have that conversation with God? There was once this beautiful book called Conversations with God. You know, Kirsty, I think it's very, very individual. I think even within us, we do different things at different times, work. Sometimes for me, you know, like for me, I feel my most authentic means of communication is through the written word. I feel like when I speak, there's a level of artificiality that comes. But when I write, I feel like I can really be honest and reveal my heart. So for me, like, I find writing is a beautiful way to express my prayers, my heart to God. For some people, it's just doing it in their own words in front of a picture. For some people, it's, you know, what you can also do sometimes, Kirsty, is like when you go through the books of wisdom or the prayers of great saints, sometimes they're able to crystallize our thoughts better than even us. And sometimes we read one of their prayers and we're like, whoa, like that just expresses my heart. And therefore, sometimes to recite the prayers of other saints or to recite the prayers that are in the scriptures, it's not like plagiarism. It's totally okay if you resonate with it and you feel it represents your heart. You can also recite those prayers, and that can give you a very beautiful connection as well. So I would say all of these are appropriate ways to pray. Write, journal, write a letter, open your heart, speak. For some people, prayer comes through song. They just sing to God. And sometimes it's not about having many, many elaborate words, but you may just sing one or two or three lines from a song and just really deeply meditate and offer your heart in those lines. And that's another beautiful way to pray. And some people may recite verses or the prayers of saints. So whatever works for you, and at different times in your life, different things may resonate with you more than other things, and that's okay. It's all dynamic. Sometimes I come in front of Krishna and I don't know what to say. I'm just like, I don't know what to say. And that's also okay, because sometimes you can't also even verbalize it, you know. Okay, here I am. You know my heart, you know. And just like that. So I think it's no pressure. It's very natural. sometimes it may feel like Krishna's answering your prayers, or, you know, sometimes it may feel like, you know, a disconnect, but that's okay. It's a relationship, and it develops over time. Thank you. Thank you for that beautiful question. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Rajiv, have we come to the end? It's 9:30.
We have come to the end, unfortunately. And thank you so much for answering these questions so nicely. We covered a lot of nice topics. We covered Gita and resilience, difficulties. We covered purpose. We covered relationships. We covered death. We covered prayer. So it's a nice wide range of things we covered. And I do apologize for those of you who sent your questions in, but we didn't have time to do it. If you all are happy, I think we require another question and answer session. So maybe if you're up for it in a month's time, we can do something also.
It's an honor to be with you all.
So we have next week planned another session covering chapters 12 and 13. And also something exciting to share is we're going to meet face to face next Saturday in central London. And actually next Saturday is the appearance of the Gita. So it's a special day. We'll be there together for that. So there's a link on the chat just timely put on now. So please click on that if you want to join us on that day. And remember to join next Thursday as well. And also in January, we'll be looking to have a personal face-to-face engagement with Keshav Maharaj, so we can put questions to him directly, get to know each other as well. So just a reminder, next Thursday is chapters 12 and 13. Saturday, we're meeting in person. And then in January, we'll be meeting as well. So thank you all so much for joining. And thank you to Maharaj. In January, we'll be launching a course, which is 4 weeks. Maybe, Maharaj, do you want to share a bit about that course? Because I know you're quite
excited. Yeah, we're really excited about this new course. It's going to be 4 sessions, and we're going to there's so many ways to look at the Bhagavad Gita. So we're excited. In January is kind of like a new year, and we're going to come together and do this 4-session course. And then throughout next year, we're going to do a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, like what we're going to try and do, Rajiv, I hope you don't mind me sharing it with everyone, but we're also going to try and take this out of the classroom. You know, we want to give you like wisdom that breathes. So we're going to try and take a lot of what we're learning. We're going to go out. We're going to, you know, try and do something to make the world a better place. And really get active with this wisdom and apply it. So I'm really, really excited. It's so nice to see everyone on the call and such a good energy. And yeah, so there'll be a lot more discussion and exploration and active spirituality as well. So yeah.
Thank you so much. So anyone who's not on the WhatsApp group, you can share your number to questions, because I know some people might be joining for the first time. So make sure you get added to the WhatsApp group to get updates about what's happening. But yeah, thank you so much for the amazing session, and thank you all for joining.
Thank you, everyone. Enjoy your evening. Hare Krishna.